Hey everyone, Jesse from Podcast 1289 here. You're about to listen to a very special episode of this podcast featuring our very first celebrity guest, Brendan B. Brown of the rock group Wheatus. In this installment, Brendan sits down with us to discuss one of the strangest true crime cases on record, and one that occurred in his hometown of Northport, Long Island, the 1984 murder of Gary Lowers by infamous Satanist Ricky Casso. The story on its own is particularly shocking, but hearing Brendan discuss his encounters with Northport's own murderous acid king is sure to send shivers up your spine and curdle your blood. So let's listen in to this very special Podcast 1289 minisode, Meeting a Murderer.
All right, Brendan, the dude with the higher-pitched voice, that's Dan.
Hey, buddy.
The one with the Krusty the Clown laugh, that's Dan.
I'm Mike.
All right. So, I figure because Brendan and I have two interesting encounters, we both have, like, Brendan definitely has in the first degree. Brendan's met a murderer, and I had a weird encounter with a family member of a murderer, and I didn't know it at the time. Like, do you guys just want me to start out with my story? It's a quick one.
Sure.
Yeah, go.
I went and visited my family in Delaware like a year and a half ago, and my old drummer, Mac, he still lives out there, so I called him up. I was like, hey, you know, let's go grab a beer. Let's go do something. He's like, yeah, I'm hanging out with someone right now. Can I bring them? And I was like, yeah, sure. I don't care. Let's catch up. So meet him at this bar, this really cool place called Governor's Cafe. And we're hanging out, and he's like, yeah, this is my friend Gary. Totally normal, nondescript dude. Just like, hey, what's up, man? And I'm like, hey, you know, how you doing? So for like the next hour and a half, we just throw a couple beers back. We're chilling, talking about normal shit, reminiscing about the band we were in. And the night just kind of ended. Well, the next time that I went out east, this was when Brendan and I met. On our way home from Long Island, we stopped and saw my family in Delaware again for a day. And I stopped into Mac's job and said, hey, man, you know, how you doing? And he's like, oh, you know, I'm all right. Hey, you remember that guy Gary we were hanging out with? And I'm like, yeah, when we all went out for drinks together. And he goes, I found out something about Gary that I gotta tell you. You'll know about this. And I'm like, what'd he do? And he goes, oh, no, he didn't do anything, but his dad did some fucked up shit. Have you ever heard of a dude named Gary Heidnik? And I'm like, yeah, he inspired the Rape Pit in Silence of the Lambs. Yeah, he was a serial killer.
Shit.
And he goes, yeah, that's his son. I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah, Gary Heidnik Jr. And I was like, wait, I really hope you just said Harry Connick Jr. And I'm like, are you fucking serious? And he goes, yeah, we were hanging out like a couple months after, you know, we saw you. And like, he got a couple beers in him and it just all came out like, you know, my dad did some horrible things, man. And I'm like, that's fucked up. So yeah.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
No, I'm good.
So yeah, I had drinks with the son of a prolific American serial killer. That was a little mind blowing.
By the state.
The funny thing is it only took a couple beers for this guy to spill his beans about this. I mean, I would think you'd be a little bit more tight lipped.
How do you break that one to someone you're dating?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my god.
Show them the rape pit.
No.
So yeah, you know my dad. You know how I never talk about him? Here's why.
Hey, you ever seen that classic film with Anthony Hopkins, The Silence of the Lambs? Remember when he puts that lady in that pit in his basement? That was inspired by my dad.
I would imagine, I don't know, I'm trying to put myself in those shoes, which is impossible, but I'm trying anyway. Would you say it first? Would it be like the first thing you, like, you know, look, this is nice that we're dating, but eventually you're going to find this out. I really should, like, you should know this up front. My dad was a serial killer.
I don't know. I think that's something that you just kind of keep locked deep inside.
And hope that the relationship just unfolds without you having to say anything about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, pretty much. I mean, you just kind of hope that no one ever decides to, like, well, now it's a little bit different because if he was born a little, like, later, he wouldn't have had to deal with everybody like, I'm just gonna fucking Google this guy. Like, you know, you Google that name and all of a sudden serial killer pops up. You know, you'd think that wouldn't be like the first thing they go like, well, I'm just curious, what did you say about your dad? Nothing. Immaculate conception.
No, man, I think you gotta get it out front, like way early, first thing. Like, look, you know, because they're gonna find out. And then what?
Was it like the speed dating thing? Hi, my name's Gary. My dad's a serial killer. Anyway, going back to meeting murderers, Brendan, I think you have a pretty interesting story.
Yeah, so what was Ed Gein like?
I might have met Joel Rifkin, too. I mean, he was floating around in this neck of the woods for a while, driving on the Southern State Parkway and whatnot.
Yeah.
I have a friend whose dad had a dog named Rifkin, and I always thought that was the weirdest thing ever.
That is kind of weird.
He was a big-ass Great Dane. But anyway, I'm sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
That's funny. It's a bit ironic. The real Joel Rifkin was nothing like a Great Dane. He was pretty meek and slimy looking. You know, as early as I could understand it, the town I lived in was a pretty dangerous place. Lots and lots and lots and lots of fistfights, a lot of, like, vandalism and, like, quite a bit of just, I wouldn't even call it bullying, I would say, like, just sadistic.
Just,
like,
violence.
Yeah, sadistic violence, like, and if you got caught up in it, I guess you could call it bullying, but it was more just, like, the status quo of the place. And yeah. Generally speaking, it was appropriate to be afraid of older kids, the end. And they weren't going to be nice. They were probably going to kick your ass and steal your bike or whatever else. And one time I rode down to the bottom of my driveway on my little BMX and pulled out and started riding it towards a friend's house. And coming towards me were these two dudes who looked older than me. And they kind of started running towards me. And we turned around and bolted back. And I'm pretty sure that was actually Ricky Casso. It was probably the summer of 1983 or the early summer of 1983. And then the real documented certifiable one was he jumped into the car, like jumped into the passenger side window of a car I was in and hissed at everybody inside. We were
like one of those edgy kids that hangs out in front of Hot Topic.
no, this guy was really crazy. like actually cracked. I remember how big his eyes were. His eyes were tremendous, like really big and very, very wide open. But it was really weird. I mean, we had these friends down the block, and they had three girls, and my parents had myself, my brother, and my sister. And we were all the same, with similar ages, the kid groups. So, they would babysit for us, we would babysit for them, so on and so forth. And on this particular day, we went to church together, and then we jumped into their family van and went down to get ice cream and go to the park. And as we were pulling into the park, we slowed down, made the left turn into the park, and he jumped up on the running boards outside the van and came well into, like, right across the lap of the woman who was in the front seat, the passenger seat, and looked back into the van at all of us and, like, did this kind of, you know, like, really loud, guttural kind of hiss. And you can kind of see him doing something similar on the arrest video where he's being brought into jail. The day that he jumped into the van like that, I'm pretty sure he had a red bandana on and a black leather jacket and possibly a red flannel underneath the red denim jacket, but I'm not sure about that. And I remember two things. I remember, like, how he just didn't care at all that he was in somebody else's car.
Wait, he, like, let me just make sure of this. He didn't know you all. He just basically jumped into a stranger's car and screamed at everybody.
That's what it seemed to be at the time, that day. Uh-huh. When I was 10 years old. That seemed to be what was happening.
Yeah.
However, we've kind of retraced a few steps, and my cousin was living with us at the time, and she was much older. She was, like, at the time, I think, 17. She remembers this vividly, and she says that it was definitely Easter Sunday, that we were all together, that we all had ice cream, and all of it kind of makes sense, like, in the memory. But then we did a little bit of sort of deducing, and we figured out that Ricky and Jimmy Troyon had rented a house on Cherry Street, two or three doors down from my house. When Jesse asked me to help find that house, I did find it. It's this odd little property that's almost virtually on somebody else's property. So if you walk out into the Lake Bush backyard, and that's the family we were with, you could walk to their barbecue, or you could walk the same number of paces to the right and bump into this house. It's basically a finished if you had a garage on your property that was not connected to your house, that could fit about two cars inside of it. It's just a single square building with one floor that has, like, a pyramid roof, you know? And it's really kind of tucked away behind a bunch of hedges. So anyway, I've begun to think since then that maybe he had a few run-ins, because she was the kind of person who would have called the cops on somebody who had music rocking late at night or was doing something stupid, throwing beer bottles and breaking them or something like that. She would have called the police, But crazy enough, before she would have called the police, she would have confronted them herself.
Jesus.
So it's not impossible that he saw her face, having had some run-ins with her the previous summer, mm-hmm. and decided to go for the van because he saw her, because he knew them. Maybe. I don't really know. After that, I think there was a moment where I was playing video games with my cousin Ralph, who was getting sandwiches after we had just gone fishing or something like that. Mm-hmm. And Ralph was behind me while I was playing this video game in this deli, like a sandwich deli. And I thought that he reached over my shoulder and put another quarter onto the... But it turned out it was not him. It was a kid behind me, and I think it was Casso. I'm almost certain that it was him. I stole his quarter and put it in because I thought my cousin Ralph had done it. So that may be the other encounter I had with him. And then I have this other memory where I saw him walking down the street one time, and he was kind of, like, eyeballing me out of the corner, like, you know, like, looking sideways. And I think I was riding my bike, maybe, or something like that. I don't really remember. But it's vague, but he was around. He was really close by, like, while I was, like, 9, 10, 11, you know. Well, not when I was 11. When I was 11, he was dead. But yeah.
How much older was he than you?
He was 17 and I was 10 years old. He's 7 years older than I.
So did you know Gary Lowers or anything?
No, I never knew Gary Lowers. I knew a handful of kids in the summer of 1987. I started hanging out with like public school kids for a couple months. Uh-huh. And this was 3 years after the murder, and it was still very much like the stuff of legend and also very contemporary. Like, you know, the ultimate manifestation of how violent and quote-unquote tough Northport would be like, if you have a problem with a guy, drag him into the woods and sacrifice him to the devil, you know?
Jesus Christ.
That was kind of like that was the kind of vibe of this place after that. And there were people who... the big rumor that I heard when I started hanging out and being a teenager was that there were 150 people there, that he said if anyone runs, you're going to get it too, and that there was like people who knew where the body was and they would go and see it, and that they lured him into the woods. That was part of the legend too, that he was lured on purpose because they knew what they were going to do. Just there was this one kid, he would just show up sometimes. I never really knew like who he was friends with, and I didn't get to know these kids very well. It was a very short period of time, but he was like a cool young dirt, and I specifically remember somebody telling me that he was there. Now that would have made, he would have been 9 years old. Not only was I told that he was there, but when it was brought up again, it was brought up a second time in his presence. The same kid said it again while we were together, and he goes, yeah. It wasn't a canned answer. It was like, oh, yeah, you know, that, like, don't say anything, you know, like, blah, blah, blah. Now, maybe he was just being a tough and at 9 years old could never possibly have been there at all. But Northport was a really strange place. Like, you know, maybe he was somebody's little brother who heard about it and went up and saw the body during the 2 weeks that they were leading tours. Just because he wasn't there, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning when it happened, he didn't go up there in the next couple of days because he overheard his brother talking about it or something. You know, that could have been.
Jeez.
Yeah.
So what was, after like being that young age, 10 or 11, when Casso was arrested, what was like the fallout in the town like? Did everyone be like, hide your kids sort of situation? Or was it just like business as usual?
It was so dumb. Just a sort of example of it. Like, he got arrested wearing an AC/DC shirt, right?
Yeah.
Well, I already had a tape case full of AC/DC. And suddenly it was like, you know, what do you listen to? What do you listen to that shit? Like, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's going to get you in trouble. It's going to, you know, it's Dark Side, blah, blah, blah. And there was a curfew, and there was like a lot of like arbitrary arrests, or what I saw as arbitrary. Like, the cops here would take kids in just cuz. Not because you did anything, just because. It got really kind of oppressive. I got my skateboard confiscated one time because I was holding it.
Opening verse of Listening to Lightning.
Yeah, exactly. And like, there's this other thing that happened. I remember like a few years later after the murder when I was 13, there was a Getty station down on the corner of where my neighborhood ended. And they had the biggest junk pile back there, like of old carburetors or whatever else. And, you know, for years as a kid, I used to climb around back there just looking at like oily motor parts. And when I was 13, it was like I hadn't been back there for a while, but I went over because it was like you could see the pile from the side of the gas station. You didn't actually have to go behind it. I walked up behind the gas station. And I'm standing there looking at this pile. I wasn't even behind it. I was more like on the side of the gas station. Mm-hmm. I'm just looking at this pile because I wanted to see if I could find a little lever that I could repair. We had this go-kart that had been broken for years. And I was just going to try and fix it. And the two guys who ran the gas station came out. By the way, there was no attempt to hide the fact that I was looking because the walls of the gas station were glass. They both come out, right? And I was with somebody. I was with another kid from the neighborhood, public school kid. And these two guys are like, well, are you trying to steal that motorcycle? And I'm like, motorcycle? What? And I look around, and way up high, hanging from hooks, like where I could never possibly reach it, is like a Yamaha frame with the back wheel on and the front tire is off, and it's like totally destroyed, right? So I'm like, no, what are you talking about? And the guy makes up a lie right there on the spot and goes, no, I saw your hands on it, man. You were trying to lift it off of the hooks. And I was like, I can't even reach that high. What are you talking about? Like, that's nonsense. And he goes like this. He goes, you want to get taken in? And I was like, for what? I didn't, like, what are you talking about, man? Like,
what did I do?
He's like, I saw you with your hands. He's totally lying. Like, he knows, he and I both know that he's lying about this. That, like, I did not touch any of this stuff. I was standing there 5 feet in front of this junk pile looking at things. The motorcycle is on a wall behind the junk pile, so I would have had to, like, climb over it to get – and he's making up this story. Like, what the fuck? Like, what do you do under those circumstances? You can't even, like, if you're going to walk around, you're going to get harassed, like, just out of nowhere. I mean, I was 13 years old. I was like a little boy, you basically, you know?
Yeah.
And I was lucky. I was only mingling with the local crew here for, like, 3 months. And, you know, there was lots and lots and lots of vandalism and weirdness and bad things and a guy burned down a gift shop with a jumping jack because he threw it through the mailbox while it was closed. Like, lots of stuff like that. Like, big, like, burn down a store kind of vandalism, you know? It was weird, man. It was definitely strange, and I didn't know how weird it was until I got out into the rest of the world. But I was lucky because I got kind of sent away. You know, it's one of the reasons that I didn't go to school here is because of the murder, you know? My parents were like, hell no.
Well, yeah, because your mom came in with the newspaper the morning after they were arrested.
Yeah, I was sitting outside with a kid from down the block because we were planning to build a fort in my backyard. And my mother comes running out in her nightgown with the newspaper rolled up in her hands. And she's like, do you know any of these boys? Do you hear about any of this? You know, and I didn't know. I had no idea what she was talking about. And she was freaked. She was so freaked because she had just read about the body having its eyeballs stabbed and, like, all this gruesome, like, satanic sacrifice news about something that happened 2 weeks prior in the woods behind her house, you know?
Yeah.
So it was Newsday or the New York Times or something was saying it, you know, some big deal was telling her about what happened in her backyard, you know?
Yeah.
Well, listen, guys, I hate to jam, but I gotta go and pay some bills before it's too late for me to know what I'm paying.
Yeah, I know that feeling, man.
Yeah, so thanks.
Yeah, thank you. It was really nice talking to you all.
Yeah, this was cool, absolutely. Dude. This was a lot of fun, man. You know, thanks for, like, hopping on. And this was kind of, like, surreal for me, too, because Mike was the guy that, like, you know, got me into your music back when we were in high school. So now it's like everything's kind of come full circle.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's cool. Well, I'll do it again. I mean, you know, if you guys want to do it again, I'll gladly jump on.
Yeah, hell yeah, man. Anything you want to talk about, because I'm sure you're sick of talking about Casso.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, the thing that happens every time I talk about it is I want to get some kind of new insight, and unfortunately there really isn't one, you know?
Do you think that there isn't one because you think you know everything there is to know, or there's like an invisible wall stopping you from getting to that insight?
I would say that the information, if it exists, is so far under lock and key and very difficult to verify.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have this other standard now where everything got YouTubed and there's a video of everything somewhere, and, you know, there's surveillance video of somebody doing something, and then somebody, you know, has proof on their phone that it happened and all this. And we don't have that with this. This is kind of like gone.
No, it's all verbal.
Yeah.
If Ricky had been born and died of a drug overdose at 17 and never got into, like, any other kind of trouble before that, there'd be no documentation of him. He'd have no internet presence, and he would only exist in his birth certificate, his death certificate, and whatever Polaroids his family took. And that's kind of, like, weird.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird that people before this age were able to kind of pass through existence and leave very little of a footprint.
Yes, it's kind of sad.
Well, it was the last age of the possibility of anonymity.
Yeah.
Very much so. Well, Brendan, you got to run. Thank you very much for coming and doing this.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate that. I definitely, definitely. And I will talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thank you, bud.
I grew up in a seaside town where the devil lives. Bonfire lights in the woods at night said to be afraid. Down the street past the sweet shop, kids dipped in angel dust. Up the block, crooked cops always look the other way. Took my board away.